Everyone on the phone, we're about to get started. So, but if everybody could mute your phone line, it'll help us on this thing.
All right, everyone.
Yeah,
hopefully, we didn't lose too many people from the little barf fire today, but welcome. I'm David Lazarowitz. I'm a partner here in Perella in the environmental law department, and co-chair of our Clean Tech Renewable Energy Practice. And on behalf of Perella, the Environmental Law Institute, and University of California, Berkeley School of Law, I'd like to welcome you all here. This is our eighth session of our Renewable Energy Speaker Series. And interestingly enough, when we started the series about 2 years ago, we kind of focused on the gold rush aspects of renewable going on in California. So it's very appropriate that we're coming around full circle and now talking about the current state of the solar industry and whether the sun is still shining on the solar industry. So I'll hazard a guess that hopefully the answer to that is yes, and we're going to learn a lot more about that tonight. So I just want to give you a heads up. We should have another panel coming up in August or September. I believe we're going to focus on the permitting aspects of going from thermal to PV for solar facilities. So it should be very interesting. Some CEC issues should be teed up for that. And we'll, you should all be on our list now, so we'll go ahead and get the email notification out to everybody. So as you saw, we have a reception afterwards, so please stick around. And I am going to turn it over to Nat Bullard, who will introduce the panel. But it's probably appropriate that I introduce Nat. Nat is the Director of Content for Bloomberg New Energy Finance, the Clean Energy Carbon Markets Power and Water Analysis Group within Bloomberg LP. Nat oversees cross-sectoral analytical projects in clean
energy.
It's tough, but...
It reads better on paper.
In clean energy with a focus on international trade, the solar industry, and innovative financing mechanisms for clean energy. He works closely with Bloomberg's sustainability team in guiding the company's own clean energy and energy efficiency investments. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nat.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everybody, for coming as well. This is a pleasure. When David and I first started discussing this idea, we were looking back on the gold rush days that kept both of us very, very, very busy. And in the face of a lot of political rhetoric that talks about somewhere that it's somehow a doomed industry, we were sitting and talking to each other, and we said, oh, it's either a doomed industry or it's growing 50% a year, but it can't be both. So it's time to do a bit of rationalization with some market participants who can talk about what's actually going on. You know, what does the market look like on the ground? What is it that as Californians we should be most aware of or most focused on? And what is it that if we were to tell the story ourselves, we most want to tell as far as what is successful, where there are pitfalls, where there were just simple outright mistakes that people shouldn't repeat again, or more importantly, there are real learnings to be had as far as what an energy mix that could be 15% solar in the next 20 years is going to look like in California. We were originally going to have five of us here, but it says something about solar that the two folks who aren't here, Rick O'Connell from Black & Veatch and Gianluca Signorelli from Rabobank, were both pulled away respectively for a very, very important piece of project planning that Rick had to do as an engineer and a meeting at the White House on Gianluca's part. So yet a bit more evidence that the industry can't both be doomed and very busy at the same time. So very happy to have Danny Abudjian from Sunrun, Sean Gallagher from K-Road Power, and Dave Stoll from Perella Braun Martell here with me. And what we'll do is, you know, the standard. We'll do a bit of chatter amongst ourselves, and given that we're only four up here, I may take a bit of moderator's prerogative and throw in some thoughts of my own. But then I'd like to open it up to the room, and I'll do that once the time gets right and we've got some smart people in the room here to ask questions and probably offer some thoughts as well. So, you know, the idea is let's get through the perceived world of solar versus the reality of solar and the interplay of technology, markets, and in particular this funny market that we call California. And then a look within solar as to, you know, where there are differing competencies and differing successes as far as aspects of the downstream. You'll notice that there are no manufacturers up here, and there's a reason for that. But with that, let me just go down the table, and Danny, give me the story. Tell me where you are at Sunrun and where you see solar right now as an industry from your perspective.
Great. So I work on the finance side at Sunrun. I'm a director of finance focusing on debt and particularly securitization. For those of you who don't know, Sunrun is a third-party residential solar developer or service provider, as we like to call it. Today we have about 23,000 customers. We have about a third of the market share in California, in the California IOU service territories, the investor-owned utilities. We've been spending about 5 years providing the financing product, so the 20-year power purchase agreements and leases with homeowners, as well as operationalizing the model to really get solar on the really small scale to scale, as a business. One of the perceptions versus reality things that I'd like to point out is, at the residential scale, it becomes, while finance is the ante into the business, it becomes a lot about all the processes and procedures and technology around getting a business to scale. And one of the things that we decided to do was to adopt a channel distribution model where we work with the top installers in a given market. And that's been proven to be the quickest way to scale and kind of build share. Specific to what I do, I guess more to your point, on the finance side, it's really, there is a finance product, and we are looking at, right now, at the securitization market. So you may have heard a lot of noise out there, a lot of talk about, is solar ready for securitization? So we're definitely kind of working through that process right now and, really figuring out what the credit story is. So it's not your single asset, 20-year PPA asset. It's a consumer that you're financing. So getting through all those challenges as well as on the servicing side. So that's kind of what we're busy with these days.
Excellent. You've already hit on something that I'll come back to later, which is the first thing I hear is service provider, not solar company, right? So we'll dig into that a little bit later, I think. Sean, how about you?
Sure. So I'm Sean Gallagher. I work with K-Road Power. K-Road is we're an IPP solar developer. We want to develop, own, and operate solar power plants, PV power plants. K-Road was founded by William Kriegel, who was the founder of Scythe. Scythe was, one of the first big IPPs. So that business model is develop, own, operate. That's what we want to do in solar. We've got sort of two primary pieces of the business. When K-Road started up a few years ago, the primary focus was developing new projects on Indian tribal reservations. And the idea was that the BLM gold rush had overwhelmed the BLM. There's a lot of Indian land in the Southwest that's being underutilized. We could sort of get around the big bottleneck of the BLM. Go through the BIA, which is the environmental permitting for projects on Indian land, and more efficiently permit projects that way. Second part of the business is sort of in recognition of the fact, in the last year or so in particular, recognition of the fact that the market is pretty well saturated in the West for renewable projects, and new greenfield projects are going to be sort of hard to bring through from start to finish over the next few years, at least in the near term. K-Road's also embarked on a pretty aggressive acquisition line of business. So we, and to tell you a little bit about each of those things, we're just about to finish the environmental permitting on the first large solar project on Indian Reservation in the U.S., a 200-megawatt project outside of Las Vegas. The EIS is done, and the record decision will be out later this month. We're in offtake discussions on that one as well. And then on the other side, we recently completed the acquisition of a 25-megawatt PV project that was developed by SunPower, is under construction now. It'll be operational not long from now. So I guess one thing, what I'd say, just sort of to kick it off, is one thing that's happening is there's a heck of a lot of solar that's under construction right now. Most of this was approved in the sort of 2010-2011 timeframe. There's a couple of solar thermal projects. There's a lot of PV projects that are under construction, and so you're going to see a lot of power coming online in the next couple of years. You know, a corollary to that, or one thing that that means, is that there's been a lot of successful financing of large solar power plants. And on the PV side in particular, you know, we recently closed a financing for this project at Modesto that we acquired. And, you know, the bank markets are pretty willing to lend money on big solar projects. Mm-hmm. You know, they understand what these projects look like, what they are, what the various components of them are, and you know, I'm not saying that's easy, but it's very doable.
Right. Excellent. Dave, how about you?
Sure. So my name is Dave Stahl. I'm a partner here at Ferrella. I'm going to apologize in advance for my voice combination of a cold and being at a Giants game last night that got a little loud. So, but with that, so I get to play the soft-spoken lawyer, which I don't typically get to play. So my practice is a broad-based practice. I'm a work in business transactions and intellectual property, and over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been doing a lot of work in the renewable space, particularly the solar space, and mostly in utility scale development and mostly early stage acquisition through development to the sales side of the projects. And you know, following up on what Sean said, you know, one of the themes that I think I want to carry through here is that there's just been a tremendous amount of uncertainty and unpredictability in the markets, in the development process, for a variety of reasons, whether it be regulatory or permitting or financing and what have you. And Sean's point, you know, we've gotten to a point where a lot of these projects have gotten all the way through that process, have been financed and have started construction, and that's very positive. But there's also just a tremendous amount of backlog, broken projects, assets out there that people are looking to monetize and put together. And I think still working through a lot of the questions of, you know, what can we do, what flexibility do we have, and those issues. So for me, and looking about where we're going, you know, one of the interesting things from my perspective is there's just been a tremendous amount of learning on a very steep learning curve that's been going on in the last couple of years. And I see projects, you know, again, Sean's point, greenfield multiple 100-megawatt projects are just less likely in the future in the West, particularly in California, maybe some other states where transmission is starting to open up in New Mexico or otherwise. But a lot of those large projects seem to be shifting overseas to emerging markets. Here, I think the shift is more towards the distributed model, you know, maybe under 20 megawatts and much smaller, all the way down to the residential market, where I think there is tremendous opportunity and a different set of issues to deal with, but also just a lot of learning that will hopefully make the approach more programmatic, because it has to be, you know, there's simply no way to have these, you know, the numerous, you know, to have 50 projects all sort of cost the same from a transaction perspective as what we've gone through in the last couple of years with some of the larger projects.
I mean, this is, you know, even within California. California is its own market separate from the United States. Solar is a separate energy market within that. But I would say that you're still looking at a half dozen separate markets for solar energy. I mean, if you were to strip out the word solar from the description that Danny gave you of his, then from what Sean describes, they don't really sound that much alike at all. So I'd be interested to know, just to start off, it's like, what aspect of what you do is unique to solar, and what aspect of it is simply rationalization of, in your case, creating a services company, and Sean, in your case, creating a power company? What do you think?
Sure. I think going back to the earlier point and what you just mentioned, it's really about creating that services company, because, you know, when we got going, you know, we focused on the residential market because, you know, solar was a fairly expensive technology, and we looked for the most expensive power to go offset. And this, you know, this ties a little bit into, you know, every market is different. We started in the California market, where, you know, residential customers, as many of you probably know, pay, you know, of the, you know, highest power costs in the country. And you know, that's where the unit economics really worked. And there was a good incentive program. The challenge was getting, you know, that business model lined up that really allows you to scale. And, you know, take hundreds of customers to thousands of customers to hundreds of thousands of customers, and that involves a lot of technology that doesn't exist for the asset class and for the industry. So, you know, how do you monitor 15,000 meters a month? How do you give real-time production data to your customers? How do you bill them if you've got a power purchase agreement with a production guarantee? How do you make sure you're giving back the right amount? So all of these factors involve heavy investment technology, and you know, going again back to the perception versus reality point, we're about a 180 person company, and maybe a quarter of that is in technology and engineering. So we you know, we do position ourselves as a technology company as much as we do as a finance company and a solar company.
But it sounds like you're finance and technology paired together first, and then solar is obviously necessary. But how many solar engineers do you have? How many PV specialists do you have? People who analyze module efficiencies, performance, and stuff like that.
Sure. So we've got an operations team that you know, part of the operations team does fleet servicing. One of the unique things about our business model is we're relying on third parties to do a lot of the different pieces of the chain, and you know, one of it is installation. So how do we know we're partnering with a company that is building these things correctly? How do we know that you know, they're procuring the right equipment, you know, and we're getting the warranties that are really bankable? So we do have that in-house expertise. You know, we have a lot of processes around making sure that the network we work with and you know, the whole ecosystem kind of works well from a risk mitigation standpoint. So we restrict the installers we work with. You know, we work with about 30 of the top mm-hmm. installers. Each time they find a customer, they can only use the equipment that we allow them to use. So these are really, we view this as assets we're putting our money into for a 20-year period. And as well, we have a 20-year customer relationship that we want to, you know, where we want to keep the customer happy. So we do have those processes, and it's a relatively smaller part of the company by headcount, but still as important.
Sean, what is the magic tipping point that makes a group of site power people decide to get into solar when you could have just stayed doing gas? Like, what was the moment? Actually, I'm going to get, I know that Dave is going to have a thought on that too. So what's the magic moment that makes that happen?
So, and I'll say, and just before I get there, I'll say, you know, there are a number of similarities between our two companies,
even
though they're very different, right?
Okay.
I mean, it's because technology is important, and technology selection is important. How you select the technology is important. Financial engineering is extremely important to our company.
I think that's safe to say. Right.
Right? And the partners that you work with, extremely important for both for our company and for theirs. We're, you know, I'm not going to say it's exactly similar, but we also do a lot of work through third-party contracts. For the Scythe guys to get into the power business, I think it was a recognition that this is the way the country's moving.
Okay.
And, you know, the Scythe guys are, like, I got into the renewable business because I came out of the PUC, and I got into the renewable business to save the world, right? These guys got into the renewable business to make money.
Right.
And they're very cold, you know, businessmen. And they saw this is the way that the world is moving, and they thought that they could provide a service. They knew how to do things, and they could do it. And they knew how to develop and own and operate power plants efficiently and make money doing it.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, you dealt with on the planning and permission side a universe of different kinds of companies, from, to be honest, a lot of small companies that were at the limit of their design and being able to build something so big, and very, very large companies for whom it was a matter of course. So how did that, like, how did you see the landscape of the people building big projects in the time that you were, when the time you're now still active with it?
Sure. I mean, it's been interesting because you did start out with a couple companies that were out to sort of save the world, and a lot of them came out of, you know, some dirty energy, you know, paths and wanted to do that and also looked at an opportunity. But then you had this great land rush or whatever you want to call it, where everybody was running around tying up assets and they saw opportunity. And what you ended up with was you had quite a mix of players, and you would have, you know, people who were just, you know, pure, you know, land developers down in Kern County or something that wanted to, you know, their plan was to put a community in place, and so they tied up all the land, and they realized, well, that's never going to happen, and all of a sudden they're sitting on a great solar resource, and they go get an interconnection queue position, and they've got something valuable, but they have no experience in the solar business, and they figure this out, and then they decide they need to pair with somebody who does have the experience, and frankly, those transactions are very difficult when you're dealing with people who don't really know what they're doing, don't know what they don't know, but are sitting on great resources. And you also have, you know, a lot of times the dynamic that I've seen, it's interesting, is that you have two parties coming together who all of their interests are in line, but they're trying to figure out the regulatory hurdles. They're trying to understand what are the prospects that my PPA is going to get approved, and what are the prospects that my interconnection is going to work out. And really a lot of the time that we spend in this development process is not so much negotiating against the parties that we're trying to JV with or partner with, but really trying to figure out how do we solve these novel problems. I mean, it's great for lawyers. It's a lot of creativity, a lot of novelty, and I think there has been room for it when you're developing, you know, a 500-megawatt power plant, and it's going to turn out to be a $2 billion financing transaction. It gets tremendously trickier when your projects are smaller and more numerous, and you simply don't have room for that kind of sort of transaction costs. And so, you know, really a mix of players, and my experience has been, you know, like any other industry, it makes a big difference. You know, there's a lot of cowboys out there. There's a lot of people who have different motivations and different skill sets. There's a lot of tremendously strong developers from other industries, and it's a hodgepodge. And it's been a lot of fun because it's also, there's a lot of young talent out there that's really passionate about what they're doing, combined with some more senior skill sets.
Well, I hate to invoke Donald Rumsfeld, but he nailed it when he talked about the big deal being unknown unknowns. And in this sector, having watched all of the paperwork flow through, you know, easily in the how many thousands of pages, Sean, in an application for certification once it's done?
Too many
thousands. If it starts with thousands, it's too many pages already. But you could watch the process as it evolved and realize that it wasn't a case of making it up as it was going along, but people didn't even know what questions to ask until they saw the answers to the first set of questions that they had. There was something very, very standard that came out, and after presenting that, your counterparties realized, well, wait a minute, that actually is not what I need at all. They started giving me more information. So, Sean, how much of an education effort was it, like, and I don't mean to the public, but to the actual market participants, how much of an education effort has it been in the last 5-6 years or even longer?
Yeah, it's been an education, I think, for everybody concerned, the developers, the agencies, and all along the line, because, you know, no one had ever permitted a power plant on 6,000 acres before,
right?
And I just reading the other day, so I can't remember now what it was, you know, there's somebody's got a 350 or 500 megawatt gas power plant on something like 20 acres or 30 acres.
Yeah, there's more land for parking. There's more land in the parking lot than the plant takes up, basically.
That's right. So, and we're trying to permit these. One of our first sites was 8,200 acres when we started. One of our sites was about a little over 7,000 acres when we started. And so it's very different, and the agencies just didn't know, you know, what to do about it. And I'll say the other part of it is, it's been an education for a lot of the developers who've come in from other places. So,
right.
You know, Dave was talking about the sort of the guys, the two dogs, the truck land developer guys. There's also a lot of developers who've come in from places like, you know, who developed wind projects in Texas,
mm-hmm.
or who've developed wind projects in the Midwest. And you know, those guys get to California, they don't know what hit them because it's just different here. And
California hit them actually.
And you know, it's much more complicated here. It's much more expensive here, and you know, I worked for a guy who was from Texas, and he didn't want to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's a really nice guy, for the record. I remember him well, but yeah,
right.
He was a Texas wind guy.
Now, I mean, things have gotten much more professionalized over the last 4 or 5 years, right? The
mm-hmm.
BLM, in particular, the CEC, the resource agencies, they've kind of come up now with a program of how to attack these kinds of projects, and you know, some of the rules that they put in place make it challenging for development. Actually, I think a lot of the rules make it challenging for development. But you have a little bit more of an expectation going in today of what it's going to look like than you did 3, 4, or 5 years ago, because they've now gone through this kind of lump, you know, of the first wave of projects, and they figured out more or less how to do things. And and you know, you can sort of know a little bit better. Know it.
Whoever's on the line, would you mind going on mute, please? Thank you. Danny, the scope and scale of the unknown unknowns for rooftop solar projects is a little bit smaller than it was for a giant desert plot that ended up being full of tortoises and unexploded ordnance and squatter camps and God knows what else was actually out there. But what was it, you know, what has been the process in Sunrun's time that you found that you didn't know you needed to know at first? What have been the issues that you've come to across it?
You know, I think a lot of it deals, again, with the customer. So, you know, you've got this system on somebody's roof that's going to live there for 20 years, and you know, you're signing up for this obligation. If you move from the home, it's your responsibility to get that contract over to the person that's buying your home. You know, throughout the length of that customer relationship, you know, many things will happen. Circumstances will change, you know, that's really at the core of you know, the focus of rating agencies when they look at you know, how do we assess the credit and you know, the performance risk of this product. And it's you know, things like you know, hey, I didn't save enough this month, or you know, where in California where there's a tiered rate system. If you consume a little less, you move down to a lower tier. So, or if you consume a little more, you move into a higher tier where your electricity cost moves up. And you know, how do I know I saved money? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the customer care angle. How do we and further to that, not just knowing what the issues are, how do we operationalize this?
Right.
So one example is, you know, in our contracts, our earlier on contracts, you have the ability to pay a balanced bill where we estimate your production and charge you an equal amount every month. In solar, you know, you're producing 2.5 times in the summer what you do in the winter.
Right.
So what happens is, and also solar is a variable resource, so you get to the end of the year and you have to true up.
Right.
You could have overproduced by 10% because it was a very good weather year, and all of a sudden the customer gets a bill for 10% more.
A happy homeowner gets charged for his solar system that he wasn't supposed to do. Right.
So on their 13th bill, they get you know, a $500 assessment that, you know, they necessarily didn't know about. And you know, so with the rapid growth, you know, every year you have more and more customers getting to that 1 year anniversary where they get this, and you know, it becomes you know, an operational pain that you have to deal with. So,
go ahead. Thank you, Margaret. So that cues up, you know, technology with a capital T, and now solar with a capital S. And I'm curious to hear from everybody here whether or not Solyndra matters at all to you. I'll give my context on this. I'm just back from a conference in Singapore where, with 50 solar executives, about 30 of them CEOs, not a single person gave a damn about Solyndra. In fact, it didn't even come up except for them to tell me that for Americans it just seemed like an annoying distraction, but for them they were busy doing like actual work. So does that and the intent attending sort of political cloud that goes with it make a difference, Danny, for Sunrun?
I'd say, you know, not at all.
Awesome.
I think, you know, let's just stop there now.
That's it right now.
Yeah, so we've seen, you know, this year on a new origination basis year to date, we've seen about 100% year-over-year growth. So, you know, we haven't seen that. You know, the potential headwinds are going to be from the financing side,
mm-hmm.
But that's not going to be caused by, you know, anything related to Solyndra. And I think it was alluded to before, you know, the reasons you know, for which Solyndra failed, you know, a lot of it was due to falling prices of
mm-hmm.
You know, traditional technologies, which we solely use. So we've actually been benefiting from that trend.
Which can hardly be considered bad from a sort of total welfare standpoint from solar energy, right? It can hardly be considered a bad thing that technologies outperforming even their own aggressive forecasts in terms of where they would be on market price can be considered a bad thing. However, it took an awful lot of political goodwill down with it, I think. But Sean, how about for you?
Well, you don't want to hear me start to rant about, you know, the whole, what a
this invented problem of Solyndra, right?
Oh, but I do.
No, for our day-to-day right. business, it makes no difference at all.
Yeah, right.
You know, we're like these guys. You know, we use sort of tier one bankable technologies. Period. Mm-hmm. I mean, where Solyndra's made a difference is in the policy environment in Washington. So things like getting the 1603 grant extended, Solyndra is not really related to that at all.
Not in the least.
But it matters, and so it has infected the policy environment for reasons that are entirely false, made up, wrong, but it has.
You know, to my mind, like blaming a very high-profile company that essentially vanished is easy, but talking about the nuances of a well-supplied tier one market and all the good impacts it has for people buying power is difficult. Politically, it was about as easy a target as you could get.
Right? Yeah, I would add to that because I think as you as you travel around and people know that you do work in the solar industry, it comes up. It always comes up. And you try, you could really take it to a high level and say, look, that was a product play. That was sort of almost like a bet on an unproven technology that didn't necessarily have a market yet, whereas you have other loan guarantees and grants that are tied to projects that have PPAs and are fully permitted and are very low risk. And frankly, a lot of the times, you get to project shovel ready, the risk most of the risk is behind you. And so to me, it's a very different bet that the government was making on some of this project finance. But everybody looked at Solyndra and said, well, the whole thing's a mess. And so it really clouded everybody's, I think people who don't know much about solar, they just look at it and say, well, the whole industry is a mess and we have all these problems, where it was just a very different business model, a very different risk profile with that type of deal.
Remember when Toyota had an issue with the Prius, that issue was ring-fenced with the Prius. There was not hearings that then said we should cancel our highway system and blame every single other manufacturer of automobiles, right? I mean, from a technological standpoint, it was a pretty, a pretty contained element. And I do think the Californians and us can say there's probably, at least intellectually, a higher level of comfort with companies failing because it happens out here. That's the nature of Silicon Valley, but it doesn't sing very well in D.C.
But it was also the nature of the loan guarantee. So if you're
sure, that's
honest,
what it was supposed to do.
The reason for the loan guarantee program was to put money into businesses or projects that the bank markets wouldn't put money into because they weren't mature enough.
Right.
So there was expected failure rate. There should have been a failure rate. If there weren't failures, the loan guarantee program wouldn't have done what it was supposed to be doing.
Otherwise, if there wasn't supposed to be failures, it wouldn't have needed credit subsidy money, right?
Ah.
You could have just loaned out free money to everybody. Now we gave some testimony in Washington D.C. and my colleagues said first of all sort of a roundaboutly sort of gently reminding the Senate committee, you did pass this law, you did say that this in the text of the law this is what is expected, and also you cannot both back innovation and have no default rates. It's simply not possible to have those things both working together. But politically, it took a lot down with it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
It is a bit unfortunate. I would say we're working past it here. But I'd like to hear what you guys think. Is it a passing cloud, or is it still bad? I think actually, from Sean's perspective, policy wise, it's still
so bad. Listen, the policy environment today in Washington is very different than it was in 2009. Do you remember 2009?
Yeah, I do remember 2009.
And so it is still having an impact. And frankly, our business and others like ours would benefit from the extension of the 1603 program.
Sure.
And it's been made much much tougher because of this event.
Mm-hmm. I think it's time to get some questions from the audience, because we've got a pretty well-informed group here, and everybody seems to be paying attention, which is always a good start. So let's take some questions pretty much anything. Just do me a favor, which is let me know who you are and where you're from, and make it an actual question. So it's a small room, so I don't think we need a mic or anything, but just stand up and start chatting, or if you want to be student-like, put up a hand. Otherwise, I'm going to start picking on people, because I'm looking at the peanut gallery in the back of the room, and I know plenty of people back there. So I will start picking on you if you don't start speaking up. Somebody's got to have a question. Nick, I was going to pick on you, but now you've beaten me to it.
My name is Nick Sassett. My question is for Danny.
Let me go ahead and recap that for those listening on the call. First of all, Nick, thanks. That's a very good question. The question is, what are you doing to what is Sunrun doing to move beyond simply the world of people with great credit scores, or as I could put it another way, the world of people who might actually be able to already afford a solar system?
Yeah. So, great question. So I think you know where we are now in the life cycle. I think it's actually important to keep the credit profile high, you know, to ensure that that eventually you'll have bankability on the product. We're people have short memories, but we're not too far past the days of subprime. So, we're certainly not offering a subprime product, it's quite the opposite. It's super prime, credit. While maybe there's a correlation to income, we're looking for likelihood to pay, not necessarily your demographic. So, it's important to keep that fairly high. We have pretty strict underwriting standards. And as far as, looking at it from the flip side, as far as a market opportunity, we're on the residential scale, probably 0.2% penetrated. There are probably 200,000 or 300,000 homes today that have solar on their rooftops. If you look at California, it's the 10th largest economy in the world. So, the opportunity is there to multiply maybe 100 times before you need to suffer credit deterioration in these portfolios to continue to expand the market. So I think the focus right now is keeping credit risk low to really open up the financing market. And from there, you could reach more people.
Good. Who's next? Somebody's got to have a question. David, you've got a question up front.
Yeah, I'd be curious to have you guys just project into the future a bit. I mean, we've got the experience of the last couple of years, and I'm curious about, what are your thoughts about what the landscape looks like in another 3, 5, 10 years? And obviously, Sunrun will be on top, and K-Road, and Dave's clients, so I understand that part of it. But, are we going to be, is it Chinese manufacturers on PV? Is it this independent IPP model, or is it, we're going to stick with some sort of, vertical integration? Is California built out? Is it saturated for utility scale? And are we going to be we're going to look at, Wisconsin, wherever it might be, where there's some policy initiative? But I'm just really curious, and equally for you, Nat, because I know you watch the market real closely, but all of you, where do you think this ends up? What do you think it looks like in a couple of years?
Go ahead, Sean.
Sure. So I can say a couple things. I mean, first point is I think I'd echo what was said earlier, which is that I think, and this was actually said to me by PG&E today, the era of 500 megawatt PPAs is over, right? And so the market is moving in California. I think in the West, generally, it's already moved there to smaller projects. Most projects in the next several years will be on the, even utility scale projects will be on the order of the 20 to 50 megawatt project, right? That's what the utilities want. They don't need the kind of volume they needed 4 or 5 years ago. There's a perception that the smaller project can be brought online more quickly and with more certainty, and so you're going to see the market moving in that direction. You're also going to see, people moving into other markets, right? So we're working in Massachusetts, for example. And there's still plenty of states that, haven't created a solar market yet, and that will as time goes by. So we're not sort of recognizing that, California, Nevada, Arizona, the places where the sun really shines, the market is going to be slow in the near term. We're looking at other places, but we're also keeping our foot in the door in the southwestern states, because we are going to see projects fall off. We are going to see the economy pick back up and the demand pick back up. So I don't think it's smart for anybody to abandon these markets.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would just add to that. Certainly I think that we are moving towards smaller projects. But there are a handful of large potential projects that are still out there. And one of the problems that has bogged the process down is you've had a lot of players, sort of try to realize these assets, and then they hit a stumbling block of one sort or another, and they have to sell the project to somebody else. Maybe there's a technology change. I mean, we had one project that started out as like a combined CSP biomass project, and next thing you know, we're negotiating a PV power purchase agreement, a completely different project, same PPA, but you have, you know, sometimes you have project assets that have been in three or four people's hands, and because there's so much risk in the development, all of the consideration is sort of contingent on hitting these eventual milestones that everybody helps you hit. You know, get that PPA approved, hit financial close, commencement of construction, and it makes for some creative deals because you have to deal with all these legacy issues of all these parties that are still at the table. There's still some big ones going on. A lot of times these projects die. A lot of times they just stall out. You know, companies go into bankruptcy. What does bankruptcy do for BLM right away? I mean, there's a lot of interesting issues, and you know, sometimes you look at some of these project sites, and you know, I have to say, skeptically, I think, you know, boy, they might just be better off just wiping the slate clean and starting over, but you still have these wonderful sites that everybody kind of agrees would make a great project. And I think it's really, and there's still a lot of players chasing some of these larger scale projects. But I think once that eventually shakes out, which I think it will in the next couple of years, you know, certainly you'll have smaller projects. There's less negotiation necessary in the PPAs. There'll be more certainty in the interconnection. There'll be less, 10-mile long gen ties and issues. All the issues will simplify, and I think it'll be a more programmatic approach, which I think will push costs down even more and hopefully get towards, you know, what everybody's been trying to achieve, which is, you know, a resource that's competitive with the traditional energy resources.
I actually agree with you. I think that if you were to wipe the slate clean in a lot of these projects, it would be easier to get them going.
Yeah.
To essentially just start reboot them with all that we know right now. And also what we know to just avoid doing. So right. I'm going to turn that one around for you, Danny, because everybody else has been talking about things going smaller in size, but in 5-10 years' time, is Sunrun doing bigger projects?
So right now, you know, the focus is certainly residential. Right. I think, you know, we get asked that question all the time, and we've looked at commercial scale projects.
How big would you say when you say commercial?
Commercial scale in the, you know, several hundred megawatt range. So our average system is probably somewhere around six kilowatts. So
that was several hundred kilowatts or several hundred megawatts?
Several hundred kilowatts.
Okay, all right, good. Because all of a sudden Sean's giving you an evil eye over there.
No, I have to say it's a very large roof.
It's a very, very big roof. I've seen some big ones, but nothing quite that big. Okay, so several hundred kilowatts. All right, fair enough.
But yeah, so the focus is on, and we anticipate it'll continue to be on the residential scale. I mean, it's really heads down on, you know, developing all the processes to get this thing to scale.
My guess, if you want it, is that in 5-10 years' time, we don't have discussions like this because, like any good technology, solar just sort of vanishes into ubiquity. We will still notice things like a 500 megawatt project just because it's going to look pretty distinctive. The same way that Solar 2 used to on the I-15 before Southern California just blew it up because it didn't work anymore. You'll notice them for their size, but I think in terms of noticing them as a distinctive technology, you'll stop noticing that a roof has it because most roofs do. And you'll stop thinking about the so much, such an intense focus on the technology of them, and simply it was whether or not they work. Like, so you'll the way that you would notice right now a conference room that has a cathode ray tube television in it, but you don't notice that they have a flat panel screen because everybody does. You'll start to notice houses in certain sunny parts of the world that don't have solar on them. You'll start to notice that people are opting out rather than opting into an energy source like this. It's a little bit more of a philosophical answer, and maybe it's a little bit longer run than 10 years, but I honestly, that's where it goes if it matches the promise that's actually out there.
Yeah, one interesting thing, and I don't do a lot of work in the residential market, but is, you know, it's the overall energy usage, right? I mean, you have houses that have old appliances, they're extremely inefficient, and, you know, yeah, it's great, put a solar panel on the roof, but, you know, there's so much opportunity to to, you know, increase efficiencies in homes. And I think that's where it'll be really interesting is it'll be solar in combination with a lot of other upgrades and technologies and building and everything else that will really be a compelling model to, you know, for companies, I think, like, you know, like your company. And it's just an interesting opportunity because it's been fun to play in the big market, but so much of the future is going to be on the smaller scale. And I think it's really, you know, looking at the overall energy usage and how we can be more efficient in the broader area that I think there's a lot of opportunity.
We've got a question in the back. Yeah, please.
Yeah, hi. Tim Wendell from Keystock and Weedman. I think that a major issue right now, certainly with the California Independent System Operator right now, is the variability of renewable resources. The sun has been shining, no energy is being efficient. And at the Public Utilities Commission right now, procurement choices are really coming to a crossroads as far as what technology is California going to choose to fill in the gaps in variability. One choice is, you know, tripling the size of the natural gas fleet of the state, and the other choice seems to be energy storage, demand response, energy efficiency, and all of those technologies. My question is just on storage, and wanted to know to the extent to which your companies or your clients are looking towards storage and perhaps coupling solar technologies with storage technologies to become more of baseload generation as opposed to as available.
So for those dialing in, the question is about incorporating energy storage, one form or another, to essentially bridge the potential variability, the variability issue you have in PV and make it more like a shoulder or a baseload resource. Who wants to take that?
Well, I'll throw out a story that I'll never forget, which is back in, I think it was, it had to be around 2009, maybe early 2010. I was in New York, and we were walking through Manhattan, and I was talking to somebody about this exact issue of, you know, what's your biggest concern, what's your biggest, you know, kind of the lawyer question we all love to ask. And it was variability and you know, intermittency, and how do you deal with this? And we talked about storage, and he said, well, you know, you look at that city block over there, and he says, that's how big your battery would have to be with what we know about storage today. And I'll just never forget that sort of dynamic. And we did a panel 6 months ago on this, and you know, frankly, the short answer is I have not seen a lot of concrete movement or examples in terms of storage opportunities on the PV utility scale. I'm sure there's a lot of people working on it. It just, for the projects that I've worked on, I haven't seen it yet. It's certainly something there's been a lot of talk for a lot of years, but I'm just as curious as you are, I guess, to see where that goes.
Yeah, from a policy perspective, storage is the holy grail, right?
Right.
But the problem with storage is that it's expensive, and from a developer's perspective, storage is a technology play, right? Every storage technology really is either a cost play or technology play. And from our perspective, we don't want to be taking technology risk. So we're not going to be the ones who develop whatever the winning storage technology is going to be. Somebody is going to develop a winning storage technology. I don't know when. There's going to be storage on the grid, whether it's big storage, compressed air storage, or whether it's small storage at individual generating facilities, or whether it's some combination. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I feel relatively certain that we're going to see it in our lifetimes. But it's just not developers like us that are going to be the ones that spend the money to develop those technologies and figure out which one's the winner. I mean, I like from a developer's perspective to make that the ISO's problem, right? The ISO's got to run the grid. They should spend the money. That's not the way they want to. That's not necessarily the way they want to see it. But it's interesting because a couple of years ago, we were hearing a lot about storage. You know, because I was working for a CSP company that was not. It was dish Stirling, right? So we didn't have the ability to do thermal storage, and we were getting a lot of questions. Well, the troughs and the towers can do thermal storage. You know. What's your guys' strategy on that? And our response was, well, how come you're not asking the wind guys the same question? And today, I work for a company that does PV projects, and you see a lot of PV projects get built, and I don't hear people asking the PV companies the storage question in the same way I heard the storage question being asked a few years ago. I'm not 100% sure what the reason for that is, but I don't hear that question being asked.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Danny? you got to have somebody who's asking you, when can I put a battery on this system?
Yeah, I mean, I think I echo what was said about the it's just cost prohibitive. You know, I think, you know, that's the customer's perspective, you know, or rather from the customer's perspective, right now at least, they are able to, you know, get effective storage through the net metering that they get. So, you know, if you're not at home during the day, you know, the meter spins backwards and you get credit for that at night. I mean, that doesn't address your question, but, you know, from our perspective, that energy that the customer's paying for is not currently being lost.
You know, I'll give the international perspective, which is that right now the feed-in tariff in Germany, the residential feed-in tariff, is actually worth less than what you pay for retail electricity rates. So all of a sudden, you have people selling in an integrated PV and battery system in sunny Germany, right? It's a matter of what market you're comparing it to. If you're comparing storage to the cost of balancing load with a very, very cheap wholesale electricity, then it doesn't work. But if you're comparing it to high retail prices, or if you're in a place like Japan where the utility is interested in paying to reduce the load within the grid, then there's a possibility for it. I mean, all of these things, I would say, work at a cost point, right? It's just a matter of who's willing to pay for it. Does the system operator have a need for it? Does the retail user see a savings for doing it? Will somebody finance the system? Will somebody guarantee it? Then yeah, I think that the play is there. It's just right here and now at the moment, there's not really a need for it. Despite all the questions, if it was really, really absolutely necessary, somebody would be doing it already. Yes, please.
They're actually, so BrightSource and Solar Reserve both have storage as, you know, as part of their project. And my understanding is that, you know, SCE is asking for that as an option on some of their projects. So I think, you know, if there's a place to look in the next 2 or 3 years as some of their plants come online to see how that works, if, you know, if it's molten salt or if it's, you know,
for 2016 and 2017 delivery, it's, you know, that's what our models tell us too. That's about the point where you either get paid to do it or you get penalized for not doing it. So, you know, the question is, in the next year, does somebody decide to go out there and build a 20 megawatt hour battery the way people do in Hawaii, for instance?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a good point. You hear that a lot, right? That there's no one technology that's the solution for everything. It's really a combination, and I think somebody from BrightSource a long time ago in one of the first panels called it, you know, a symphony of all the different technologies that's going to be necessary to level it out. And it seems it's more logical that, you know, typical baseload plants are going to, you know, be there, and CSP maybe is going to help, you know, and pulling all these different types of, and maybe wind from different areas and better transmission sharing and those issues are, and it's challenging, but storage just, you know, it's the holy grail, but it does seem like it's a ways out yet before somebody can really make storage have an impact on a larger scale, maybe outside of the CSP area.
Well, and if the if you see a lot of rational actors deciding that I'll take a bet on $4 an MMBTU natural gas and I'll build a new gas plant that has a 50 megawatt a minute ramp rate, I'll just buy, you know, I'll just incorporate that, and I'll get a structured electricity contract accordingly, and help out all of the renewable resources that can't quite do that, and shift the problem off from the out of the project and into the system essentially. But that, I mean, that's a decision that'll get made by people with better gas forecasts than I've got. let's take one more, and then we're actually at, you know, I'm the last thing. We're the last thing that stands between you and cocktail. So. Let's say we got one up front.
Stephen Smith, Solvita Energy Group. I had a question about technology risk on the small scale and the large scale. We talked about how much easier it is to go with a Tier 1 module and go to a bank to get finance for a very large project. You talked about financing markets and opening up well for high-credit individuals and high-credit households. I wonder, on both scales, it seems like to keep driving down costs to the point where we are seeing it as a competitive resource, there's going to have to be some disruptive technology plays that evolve in the marketplace. And I want to know if Sunrun is looking at any microelectronics distributed sort of DC optimization or microinverters, and also from a large scale, if you guys are interested in more risky technology plays, or how you see that folding into the market over the next couple of years.
Danny, what do you think?
I'm not an expert on the subject matter of particular technologies, but certainly right now we're using the standard technology, multi crystalline PV, and we're doing so with the tier one Chinese, Japanese manufacturers, a couple of European manufacturers, absent a tier one manufacturer, one with a strong investment grade parent. So the focus is really on the warranty. So it's either the equipment is really good and proven, or we have reason to believe that the parent is going to be around there to support the warranty over the 20-year period. So. Going back to the, from a financing perspective, we're not in a position to really, be trying something new.
John, what do you think?
I mean, I would echo that, and the only thing I'd really add to that is to say that the market for the manufacturers is competitive enough that they are constantly, improving their efficiencies, bringing in new models, of their panels and modules. And so even as cost continues to go down, efficiencies are going up. So you're seeing that innovation, without us having to take technology risk.
Yeah, the steady state for solar is improvement. I mean, predicting an improvement is you can predict that it will improve. What that improvement is going to be, honestly, who knows? Right. And if it works, a big manufacturer, especially if it's using a very big multinational with deep credit line, will easily back a new technology if anybody can do it.
Right, and it will be backable, and we will use it.
Yeah, and you'll use it because you like the parent company. Dave, any thoughts, or should we?
No, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, the innovation is all the way, particularly at the large scale. The innovation is not just in the technology; it's in the construction, it's in the processes, and certainly, our clients are always looking for new ways to, whether it's looking at trackers or whether it's looking at different materials or whatever it is. There's always a desire. Now, a lot of times in these markets, it's difficult to fund that development and a lot of times that's sort of a hindrance. And I think the innovation has been more less in the technology and more in the processes to try to just make the overall cost of building these solar farms lower and more efficient as the panel prices continue to come down as well.
That's a good point. So the last question is two part for each of you guys, and that's it in the year 2017, and we're looking back on 2012. What part of the market today? What part of the market today did we get right, and what part are we cringing about? What part seems quaint if we look back at it 5 years from now? What do you think, Danny?
Yeah, I think looking 5 years ahead, today, again, I speak from the residential perspective. We look at a cost of maybe $5 a watt, something a little less than that. getting down nicely,
right.
You look at that, 40% of it is in the cost of the equipment. So the other 60% is soft costs. Municipal permitting, your target market consists of busy people who may not understand solar or not as aware of it. So we liken it a lot to cell phones in the early days, where it was a very specialized purchase that, and it was an equipment purchase that required highly skilled sales labor to make the sale. Mm-hmm. And I think looking forward 5 years, relating it back to cost, hopefully it's not going to be about the equipment aspects. It's going to be about the service. So, the Verizon Wireless or the Comcast of solar is really, what we're positioning the business model to be. I think, all of the, uncertainties around solar, does it work? Hopefully all of that will be fairly quaint.
I like that. That's great. Sean, what about you?
So I'll pick up on something that Dave just said, which is that one of the real areas that there's room for improvement is in the building of the power plants.
Mm-hmm.
In this round of building of power plants, people are mostly building large PV power plants, large solar power plants, generally for the first time.
Right.
And you learn a whole lot when you build something for the first time. And so, and it turns out that, you know, building a PV plant, you know, as one guy said to me, one construction guy said to me, is just not that complicated. And as people do a couple of these, they figure out what's not complicated about it, and it can become much more efficient and much more cost-effective. And, you know, and that will continue to drive costs down because there's a limit, you know, to how far the equipment costs can go. But
mm-hmm.
So you'll see the next big round of cost improvements in actually the construction and operations.
Dave, you get the last word.
Yeah, no, I would just add to that. I think, you know, in 5 years, we'll probably look back at this time as, you know, it's a little bit of the Wild West when a lot of the learning was going on, and there's just so much inefficiency in every aspect of the development process, and so much unknown and uncertainty. And I think I hope that in the future, with smaller projects and with just more experience, that every aspect of it will have been done several times over, and we won't be spending so much time trying to figure out, who's going to have jurisdiction over my project. You know, something that David tries to explain to me on a regular basis, and just all these issues that there's so much uncertainty about what's going on, and I think in the future with smaller projects and a lot more experience, it'll just become more programmatic, a lot more straightforward, and a lot more efficient and easier to pull off.
I like it. I've got a couple of math ones. You know, I think we'll look back and we'll laugh about the fact that we'd forgotten that at any given moment, solar has not been that cheap and will never be that expensive again, right? It's always, we'll be laughing about the fact that we ever debated improvements in technology, or we'll certainly be laughing about the fact that we ever cared about Solyndra. We'll look back, I think, with a bit of regret almost at the politicization of everything that happens in and around solar energy, and say that there was an awful lot to ask out of what is fundamentally a semiconductor or a power plant. It was a lot to ask that it was meant to be the new innovation engine in the United States, as well as provide a lot of manufacturing jobs and also essentially create a closed-loop economy of American dominance in building things. And then the last thing I would say is, you know, don't count out a technology that creates its own ecosystem, right? Solar is one of the few things that does that in a way, again, that fewer semiconductors do. If they get cheaper and better, people find different things to do with them. They start going places that they weren't before because now they make sense. So this has been a lot of fun on my part. I hope, gentlemen, you've had fun as well, and I hope the audience has found it useful and constructive, and hopefully entertaining as far as looking at the landscape as it is right now. Dave, do you want to give us a
minute? No, I'd like to thank the panel, to Nat and Danny and Sean and Dave for joining us tonight, and all of you, please join us for reception afterwards, but join me in a big round of applause.